So we're here today with Dave Graff, the lead programmer and analyst of the Linguistic Data Consortium. Hello, Dave.
Hi, John.
So first off, could you explain your title and how that translates to tasking more informally?
Well, it's sort of an unofficial title in a way. I mean, lead programmer analyst isn't like a bureaucratic category in the Penn hierarchy, but it's something, I mean, to me, actually, it just translates to first programmer analyst, you know, the oldest programmer analyst. Anything that the LDC has to create or provide that requires any amount of technical involvement of any kind of programming, any kind of sort of working out how to implement or how to produce, where that requires either some, you know, hooking up of wires or writing of code and so forth, I would be the one that would be able to do that. Of course, now at this point, since the LDC is so huge and there's so much going on, I can't possibly do it all, and I don't. But the team of similarly titled staffers, the other programmer analysts on staff, do look to me as the person who takes a leading sort of advisory role in terms of how things should work out and what approaches we should take for solving the problems.
Since you've moved into other areas, and I know now you're building a lexicon database, and you're sort of in charge of more overarching programming concerns, can you describe the process of transferring your methods down to that younger generation that you were just mentioning of programmers who are now handling your original tasks?
At this point, it's more on a sort of conceptual basis, you know, the face-to-face dialogue to say, you know, translate it into non-technical terms. You know, I mean, I can talk to the other programmers, you know, at the level of queues and stacks and sockets and multiprocessing and so forth, and that's all fine. But ultimately, the things that get done have to be coherent and adequate, you know, and adequately understood to the non-technical staff and to, you know, LDC customers or LDC members, most of whom are, of course, technically very competent. But there are some whose main focus is really more on the humanities side of the linguistic field rather than the engineering side. So, yeah, I think my sort of advisory role is not only dealing with the really arcane technical issues and the terminology there, but also making sure that everyone is able to talk about it in a way that everyone can understand. So that's been always one of my favorite pastimes, actually, is being able to describe what's going on the technical side in a way that anybody can understand it. So that's and I think in the process of doing that, the other programmers, you know, really get a firmer grasp of what their goals are, you know, what the solutions have to provide when they come up with solutions for technical problems.
Mm-hmm. I think that actually is a lot of what I feel like you and I do together. It's trying to, for me, it's asking questions, and then you know the technical queries and whatnot to feed into the database so that we can get our groups of subjects and stuff like that.
Right. And in fact, yeah, that kind of interaction with sort of the people that are on the ground with the data doing the human side of every, you know, corpus development task, where the issues really are human-oriented. They have to be. You know, can we identify the same speaker in all of these recordings that are purported to be the same speaker? Can we identify the correct language, given that some of these languages are really very similar to each other and things of that nature? You know, how accurate can the transcript be, given, say, the quality of the signal or the nature of what's actually being said and so forth? To have the technical perspective on how to answer those questions is, you know, a vital part of the operation, but it can't happen without having that connection to the human attention or the human conception of the problem, you know, not the technical conception. I remember when I first, you know, within my first year at LDC, one of my first voyages outside the office was to go to the National Institute of Standards and Technology, where a lot of the corpus development and corpus publication had initially been done, you know, back in the late 80s and early 90s when the LDC was just being founded. And the folks at NIST were in charge of, you know, assembling, distributing the corpora and formulating test sets and test protocols and scoring techniques and all this stuff. And I remember on my first visit there to meet with them, because I knew I was going to be, everyone knew I was going to be working with them very closely over the years. They were in the middle of this evaluation project called resource management. And it involved people reading text from prompting screens. They were reading sentences out loud. It was prompted speech in a particular domain of, you know, sort of a telling a machine what to do or something like that, right? And the issues that came up were very striking, because very often the prompting text, which was, you know, the right answer, isn't what the person actually said. And I thought, well, now how are you going to score that? Right now, all they could do was take the prompt as the right answer and score it on that basis. But it really opened my eyes to, you know, the need for manual annotation on this stuff and very close attention to detail that was technically informed, but manually based, you know, sociolinguistically based, in fact. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's why I felt it was really fortuitous in 1992 that Mark Liberman contacted me about the open programming position as the LDC was about to start up, because I had spent my graduate coursework and graduate attempts to write a dissertation working primarily under William Leboff, whose whole orientation to the field of linguistics, so while very, very much oriented toward the humanist concerns of language change and how people, you know, use language, how communities use language, it was essentially, you know, unavoidably dependent on data. I mean, you had to have recordings. You had to be able to analyze the recordings. You had to do statistics based on the analysis. And if you didn't have data, you didn't have anything. I mean, intuition is fine, but, you know, it doesn't count if you don't have data. So starting with that, and then my first job outside the university was to actually do corpus creation. Some people at RCA, which at the time was in Camden, New Jersey, needed programming help, and I had learned programming as part of one of the essential things I had to do when doing coursework and research with Bill Leboff. You know, I mean, you can't do that stuff without using computers. I mean, it's just absolutely unavoidable. And so the people in Camden at RCA wanted to get their feet wet into this whole new field of doing automatic transcription or speech recognition, and they were starting from scratch, and it was a very educational process for all of us to be able to figure out how many speakers do you want, who should they be, what do they need to do, and we were doing a similar thing to the resource management type of collection. It was people reading things off a screen from a fixed vocabulary. So, but given that background, it seemed that coming into the LDC was just a natural consequence. I mean, just nothing could be more appropriate, it seemed like. And it was kind of surprising. And it's been that way ever since, you know, for the last 20 years. In fact, the things that I get the most satisfaction out of turned out to be more in line with the work at LDC as opposed to, say, completing my dissertation, which, of course, never happened. But that's how it goes. So I'm not, you know, I have no title, but I, you know, in terms of academics, but I feel that my experience here at LDC counts for quite a bit more, mm-hmm. frankly.
And could you go over some of the early days of the LDC and what we were collecting and creating at that point and how it's changed?
Yeah. Well, it's been, I mean, the first couple years at LDC, it was a relatively, certainly compared to what we do today, I mean, it was massively less ambitious. And you have to take into consideration the entire setting. I mean, in a way, the environment, you know, then versus now is kind of like comparing, you know, air travel in 1948 versus air travel in 1968. You know, that 20 years between, you know, propellers and
jet engines.
And then you're landing people on the moon, right? Mm-hmm. And so, like, when we started in 1992, there was no web. There was no wireless communication. There was no And really, the prospects for speech recognition or speaker identification or any of the computer-based solutions for dealing with actual spoken language or even written, you know, machine translation, totally impossible. I mean, I came into this job in 92 looking at some of the projects that were in progress at the time and, you know, the research goals of transcribing from an arbitrarily, you know, an arbitrary size vocabulary or recognizing who's speaking or translating from one language to another and thinking, these people are dreaming. There's no way this is going to happen. I mean, it'll be fun. It'll be, you know, it'll be interesting work, and the results that we produce in terms of corpora that are available for general research is all going to be very good. I mean, there's nothing bad about trying to do this, okay? But they're not really going to recognize, you know, large vocabulary, spontaneous speech. How could that happen? And, well, over the years, that attitude, you know, changed given the experience that when NIST put together a test set in 1996 for trying to transcribe broadcast speech. The initial results were not that good, but eventually, you know, by the time we got to 2002, it was a solved problem. In terms of the LDC itself and what we were doing, initially we were supposed to be just a transfer point between, you know, sort of a common point of communication between creators of data, customers of language technology, and developers of language technology, and between those three primary constituents. And then, of course, the additional circle of people who are into the research just for its own sake, which would always be a component of our membership. But between those three things, we were just supposed to coordinate the movement of priorities, the movement of funding, the movement of data between the three. The people who are interested in getting the research solutions created would manage the funding. And then we would sort of make sure that some of that funding got to people who would actually create the data, collect or record what was going to be needed. The first thing we actually did ourselves in terms of collection, of actually creating the data on our own, was the collection of Newswire. And shortly after that, we started to do telephone conversation collection. And then we started to do broadcast collection. And every one of those things became not easy exactly, but almost routine. You know, it's just we got better at it over time, and it just became easier for us to do it ourselves wherever possible. And, of course, creating transcriptions from recordings rather than having other people do that for us. That's been up and down. You know, we're actually now back to contracting out to do transcriptions and so forth. Contracting out to do original data collection. You know, we'll have other people record off of broadcast channels, especially when those are channels that don't actually reach this part of the world necessarily, or something like that. Mm-hmm. So, compared to the first couple of years where we were just really a sort of a point of communication between other parties doing most of the work. And, you know, stepping in, actually the big concern I remember from the first couple of years was just getting the stuff onto portable media. And again, this is, you know, what did you have in 1993? You had CD-ROMs, period. That's it. And not only that, but the only way to get CD-ROMs in quantity, you know, beyond more than just one or two at a time, was to send out a tape or some other, you know, durable medium copy to a place that would produce what they call a glass master. And then they had this complicated, expensive machinery that would, once the glass master was done and you had the label artwork all set up, it would stamp out, you know, hundreds of thousands of copies. And it was always difficult for us because these were people who were servicing, you know, the CD audio market and the big commercial software markets, you know, Microsoft operating systems going out on CD-ROM, things like that. And what were we doing? We wanted 200 copies. Well, you know, you got to be kidding. No, it cost as much. I mean, since all the costs was in preparing the artwork and preparing the master, it was pretty expensive business. You know, we never got a quantity discount.
Right.
Because we never had the quantity. And especially when you have like a really big corpus, like say Switchboard of 27 disk CD-ROM, 27 CD-ROMs, mm-hmm. and you're just going to make 100 copies or 200 copies of each, that's 27 masters. Right. And the copies, you know, if you were going to make 1,000 copies of each, that would be economical. But no, we wouldn't do that because it was the bare minimum that we could afford. So that's been, you know, a real big change over the years. The fact that we now actually manage our own replication, not only for CD-ROMs and for DVDs, and now I think we can do Blu-rays. We can do hard disks. We have this nifty machine that will generate 14 copies of a hard disk, you know, within a couple hours. Mm-hmm. That's great. So as long as the people doing the shipments don't drop them, hard disks are not that hard to do.
And how has the, in terms of technology changing for what's publicly available and what the users of our data are able to access, how has that changed and how is that? I mean, I feel like we're addressing some of it in the changes of the data.
I don't know. Sometimes I feel like we haven't quite been keeping up enough. I mean, more people would like to see more of the stuff, you know, web accessible, stop shipping stuff on physical media. And we should be pushing a little bit further in that direction. In fact, some of our data releases, at least on for limited sets of clients, for instance, when we have to transfer a lot of data to NIST or a lot of data to some other collaborator on a particular project, we'll give them accounts on our network, and they'll just copy it over the web rather than us shipping them hard disks. It's almost as fast, or sometimes faster, and actually rather more reliable in some cases. So, more of our data offerings should be sort of more immediately accessible. And you know, we're still looking for the next big improvement. We're always a little bit our desires for durable media are always a little bit ahead of the reality. You know, I wish we were using Blu-ray 5 years ago, and we're just barely starting to use it now. When we first got our DVD burner, it was like 3 years later than we would have liked to have it. I'm looking for some kind of steady state, solid state. Yeah, there's a solid state solution for storing 50 to 100 or 200 gigabytes that you can just put in an envelope this big and ship it. That would be sweet. You know, I'd love to see that, but it's probably out there somewhere, but we haven't made the connection yet, and we need to do that. We need to keep on top of that.
So in terms of packaging up data for publication, you used to be a lot more involved in that, but could you explain the process that one has to go through to do that?
Well, that's the first thing to establish is sort of inventory, you know, and that's actually surprisingly one of the harder things to establish sometimes, because especially as corpora have gotten more complex. I mean, it used to be you just have some speech files. Each one of them maybe has a text file to go with it, or you have a single collection of text data that describes the speech in some way, or you have a large collection of text by itself and it just stands on its own. There's not much else you have to do besides describe, you know, the details about how this data was created, what happened to it between the creation and the release, and what else do we know about it? What kinds of featural information is available and with what degree of detail, you know, or granularity. And part of the task is to sort of be able to establish and describe the limits of our knowledge about the data. So that the people who receive it and are going to set out to work on it will know if there are particular things they need to watch out for, or if they discover something strange, they can either realize, oh, well, this is a known problem now that I understand it, now that I've seen it, or I wonder if anyone has noticed this before and look at the description in the README file or the documentation and say, I think they might not be aware of this, and maybe someone should bring this up, as a point of discussion for other users of the data. Mm-hmm. So we try to keep our descriptions updated as comments like that come in about the data. But it's an open-ended problem, really, and it's just a question of deciding, given that you have a particular date by which you want to have this thing actually deliverable to researchers, you have to just draw the line and say, well, this is where I'm going to stop, and from this point on, this is all we know. I mean, for now, this is all we know about the data. Mm-hmm. How many files there are, how they're named, what their contents are, how they're formatted. Of course, there's the sort of we'd like to develop the make these things as routine as possible in terms of, say, if it's a particular format of audio data, confirm that all the files will behave according to what's specified for those files. And usually there's a header that says what the sampling rate is, how many channels there are, how long what's the duration, and so forth. So we have to go through every time, you know, with an automatic process and say, are the headers really true? Do they describe the files correctly? For the text data, we say, you know, it's in this language, it uses this character encoding, so the standard automatic diagnostic is that really true? Can we look at this stuff in any way that might identify parts of the text that are not in the stated language, or that contain characters that fall outside the expected character set, given that it should be in this language? And we've had, this is a case where it's always been helpful to get feedback from users. Did you know that there was a certain period of New York Times in our collection mechanism receiving data directly from New York Times over a modem that included Spanish content? Who would have known? You know, I mean, you read the New York Times every day and there's no Spanish in it, but somehow we managed to receive Spanish content and published it as New York Times English text. There was some sort of option in the electronic delivery process that, you know, they turn on certain bits or certain flags or something in the digital delivery mechanism that sort of routes data from various sources into this one, you know, modem pipeline, mm-hmm. and then we just receive it. And apparently someone had, you know, hit a key or something, and our delivery subscription settings had suddenly included Spanish for a while. And it's like, well, that was a surprise. But it led immediately to the quick and as efficient as possible, a method to check for foreign language content, you know, or check for consistency of language within a given body of text. And it's a general problem that has a general solution. And yeah, we do that now. Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of thing that changes, yeah.
Any closing thoughts?
Well, just that the fact that this is still a growth industry, you know, it's kind of surprising that after 20 years and all the progress that's been made, it's still not enough. It's like we're not getting close to the top of the curve yet. And that's another thing that I feel very fortunate about. I mean, I'm in a business that will always be fresh. There'll always be something new going on. Even if they get really sound generic solutions to things like machine translation and so forth, just getting that problem solved for the next set of languages, or figuring out how to collect data for the languages that don't have a web presence, or so, you know, things of that sort. Even if we're not directly involved in, you know, doing the real, you know, fundamental work, mm-hmm. we'll have a lot to do just in terms of supporting and circulating and giving broader exposure to the people who are doing the hard work of getting a better handle on this whole linguistic behavior thing. I mean, it's an infinite problem. There is no end in sight in terms of looking for solutions to everything. It's not gonna, you know. I guess my original frame of mind when I started the LDC is still in a sense valid, that, you know, there's all these problems that they're not going to solve them, you know, but people will keep working on them, and progress will be made. Yeah.
Yeah, to me, it reminds me of like on a graph when something is approaching but never approaches a certain limit. Yeah,
asymptotic approximation. Yeah, it's not even quite like that, because some problems, some specific, you know, research tasks will hit that sort of asymptotic maximum. You know, it's like, yeah, we're just about there. There's not much else we can do in terms of solving this. We've got it to the point where if you asked a human or a machine to do the same thing, they would behave about equally well. Mm-hmm. But there's always another issue where you're going to start out with a steep learning curve. You know, maybe it's going to additional languages. Maybe it's going to additional channels as to how good is the channel in terms, you know, is there a lot of noise? If people can understand things, but just barely, can a machine do better? Mm-hmm. Things like that. We're still not seeing the end. We're coming close. So there's lots to do.
Well, thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
Yeah.